Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Robert Wilson, Professor of Philosophy at La Trobe University. His new book, The Eugenic Mind Project, is just out from the MIT Press. For most of us, eugenics, or the science of improving the human stock, is a thing of the past, commonly associated with Nazi Germany and government efforts to promote a pure Aryan race. But this view is incorrect. Even in California, for example, sterilization of those deemed mentally defective was performed up to 1977. In his new book, Wilson critically considers the type of thinking, which he calls eugenic thinking, that drives eugenic sterilization practices, the quest for human improvement that derives from negatively marked differences between better and worse kinds of humans. Wilson also recounts his research with living survivors of these practices. The book is an eye-opening, philosophically informed discussion of how eugenic thinking is found in prenatal genetic testing, selective abortion, discrimination of those with disabilities, and immigration policy. And he also considers why eugenic thinking is so persistent. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Robert Wilson. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to our conversation about the Eugenic Mind Project. Before we get into the book itself, maybe you can give our listeners a bit of background about yourself. I mean, I know your work as a philosopher of mind, and you know this is somewhat not, I wouldn't say it's off track because the name of the book is, you know, The Eugenic Mind Project. But maybe you can say a bit about how you, your background as a philosopher and how you came to write this particular book.
Yeah, sure. I was a graduate student at Cornell University where I worked with Sydney Shoemaker in the philosophy of mind, as you've intimated. And really for about the first 10 or 15 years of my career, I mainly worked in philosophy of mind on individualism, about the mind and mental representation, computationalist approaches to the mind, did a fair bit of empirical stuff in developmental psychology with the developmental psychologist Frank Kyle. And then as I branched out into the philosophy of biology, I started to develop an interest in teaching in a subject called biology and society. And it was in that context that I first started to teach a few weeks of material on eugenics. And that was the sort of segue into that from, you know, being a fairly traditional analytic philosopher of mind with a naturalistic bent, interested in empirical material, shifting into the philosophy of science, specializing in biology, and then thinking about the social context in which biological knowledge and technology develops and gets deployed.
Okay, and I mean one of the things that you note at the start is you took a job at the University of Alberta, right? And it was your experience there.
Yeah, I started at Alberta around 2000, and it was in there, you know, this initial connection to teaching material on eugenics took on a new sort of life. I was literally in the middle of teaching a class where I had 2 weeks in the course that was on eugenics, 1 week on how bad the Nazis were, and a second week on how almost as bad the Americans were, because as you probably know, there was eugenic sterilization legislation that was in place in 32 US states, and the Nazis actually used those laws as their models for their own sterilization laws starting in the 1930s, leading up into the Holocaust. But what I wasn't really prepared for was that there was a Canadian history that I had no idea of whatsoever, and it was located very close at home. There were students in my class whose living relatives had been sterilized under a eugenic sterilization law in Alberta that was in place right through until 1972. And so that was Tuesday's class. There was a little bit of a learning curve that I had to go through between Tuesday and Thursday for the next class. I went back to the department. I said, hey, folks, tell me about this eugenic history in Alberta. I had no idea. And they said, oh, no, we know all about it. I said, how come? And they said, well, because the founding chair of our department, who was also the longest-serving provost in the university's history, John McCachran, was the chairman of the eugenics board for most of its history, right through until 1965, starting in 1928. And this double edge, the fact that there was actual active sterilization going on, so there were living members of our community who had been sterilized and were still with us, that was shocking. They were literally related to the students I was teaching. And the other side, that there was this, what I in the book go on to talk about under the heading of institutional complicity, there was this institutional complicity in the very department that I had just become a member of. Though that dual aspect really embedded me a lot closer to this eugenic history and made it a live issue for me in a way in which, you know, not being there would not have done.
One of the important aspects, as you just mentioned, is the fact that eugenics and eugenic thinking, as you put it, is a contemporary issue. It's not just, you know, Nazi Germany or somehow in the past. But before we get to there, maybe you can first, you know, tell us, you know, what is eugenics? How do we define that? What you mean by standpoint eugenics, which is another aspect of the book that you draw on from, I believe, standpoint epistemology, and then the general idea of eugenic thinking, as you put it, and also maybe finally why you call the book the Eugenic Mind Project.
Sure. So there's a lot packed into that question, but so let me try and take things in the order that seems manageable to me. So when people think about eugenics, they often think about it in one or more of three ways. They can think about it as a social movement, and when they think about it as a social movement, they typically think of it as operating for about an 80-year period from roughly 1865, 1870, through until the end of the Second World War in 1945. It was a social movement that was aimed at human improvement. And this brings us to the second way of thinking about eugenics, is in terms of its ideology or the set of ideas that made it up. And I typically think about it as a movement that's aimed at human improvement, but not any kind of human improvement. It's intergenerational human improvement. And it tries to achieve that in a particular kind of way. It tries to achieve it by changing the composition of people in future generations. It recognizes that the people in the current generation, the characteristics they have, are likely to influence the characteristics that people have in the next generation, whether it's through a strict notion of biological heredity or some broader notion. And so often intervening on people in the current generation will provide a way to influence that composition. But the crucial idea is that it's this intergenerational change that's brought about by changing the composition, and typically by thinking of there being sort of more desirable or better kinds of people for future generations, as opposed to less desirable or worse kinds of people to stock the future of the human species. And Eugenics also makes use of the latest science and technology to do this, and it did from the outset, from the time that Francis Galton coined the term eugenics in 1883. And so sometimes Galton himself even talked about eugenics as a science. So whether you think about it as a science or as drawing heavily on science and technology, I think that's an important part of the conception of eugenics historically, and why I think it's still part, one of the reasons why I think it's still relevant today. So that's a kind of characterization of eugenics. You can also, so you can pick it out in terms of being a social movement lasting a certain period of time. You can pick it out in terms of this set of ideas about intergenerational improvement over time. Or you can pick it out partly in terms of the sets of practices that it endorsed. And the most prominent sort of practice that comes to mind when people think about eugenics is that of eugenic sterilization. I've already intimated it in telling the story of how I got interested in it and talking about there being eugenic sterilization laws in the majority of US states, and it turned out in two Canadian provinces, of which one was Alberta, the other was British Columbia. And in fact, there were eugenic sterilization laws. These were laws that authorized the sterilization of certain kinds of people, that is, those who were deemed to be unfit or the worst kind of people to stop the future generations. And they were in many countries across the world, not just in North America. So there was literally a worldwide eugenics movement, if you think about this social movement, that lasts for about 80 years, ending with the end of the Second World War. So that's about eugenics and how to think about it. Eugenic thinking, and this brings us partly to how I thought about things myself as I went on, and it did link up a little bit more with my past interest in the philosophy of mind than I had initially anticipated. I became interested in, I mean, there is an interesting question, if you're a philosopher, you're interested in where conceptual boundaries are and how you tighten up your categories and think about how various things are related to one another and what falls under various concepts and so on. And I have an interest in that in terms of, well, what counts as eugenics, strictly speaking, but I'm really not that, that's not the focus of my interest. I'm interested in the kinds of thinking that underlies this set of ideas, this social movement, and the sorts of practices that I think are not merely a matter of the past now, new sorts of practices that have emerged in light of new scientific knowledge and technology over time. And so I'm interested in this way of thinking about human improvement that starts with this distinction between better and worse kinds of people, and on the lookout a little bit for its new sorts of manifestations, what sometimes people refer to as newgenics, which is a truncated, a term that truncates new eugenics. And so the eugenic mind just means, it's a fancy way, I guess, of saying this eugenic thinking. And the project part of the title of the book is this sort of, systematic set of systematic sorts of attempts to engage in eugenic thinking and the ways in which it manifests itself even now, and obviously that was brought home for me by my Alberta experience, but just in terms of there being survivors of eugenics, who a number of whom I became quite close friends with over the last 15 years or so in Alberta. But also in terms of looking at new things that were developing, new cases of sterilization, even when there weren't explicit eugenic laws that authorized them, they seem to be coming on again. Questions about how we thought about disability and human variation, how do we think about that? That's part of what I call the eugenic mind. So I have a couple of chapters in the book about human variation and the idea of subnormalcy and the role it plays in regulating how we view certain kinds of people. And so there's a connection, I think, there with racialized kind of thinking, mm-hmm. with how we think about immigration, for example, because eugenics doesn't need to operate through biological means. I mean, sterilization is a particular kind of biological intervention in the body. Manipulating genes in various kinds of ways is another biological sort of intervention, a way to achieve a eugenic goal, or it can be, but you could achieve those goals in other means through social policies, and people historically did. They did it through immigration restriction policies, where there were certain kinds of immigrants who were deemed to be less worthy in some sense to stop future generations. And there was a sort of fear about the flooding of the, you know, the white nation in America, for example, in Australia as well. There was a policy that was referred to as the White Australia Policy. It wasn't usually thought of as explicitly eugenic, but now I'm back in Australia after a long time away, I'm finding quite a bit of resonance in applying this idea of eugenics and this eugenic mind, eugenic thinking, to think about those sorts of debates, past debates, and I think ongoing debates about immigration and the kind of nations that we build and the kinds of people that constitute them over time.
Okay. Oh, and then standpoint eugenics, because that was an important aspect as well.
Yeah, so the book was originally called Standpoint Eugenics. And the basic sort of idea was trying to look at eugenics and this eugenic thinking from the standpoint of those who survived its history as a social movement. So that was the connection with working with eugenic survivors and building oral histories with them together in a large-scale project that we undertook over about a six-year period in the early 2010s. The basic sort of idea was that although you can have there are some people who are better positioned to understand certain kinds of phenomena than others. I mean, that's pretty much a truism. But the flip in standpoint theory, I think, is the idea that some of the people who are most oppressed by a certain kind of system, even though they're disadvantaged in all sorts of ways because of that oppression, are the people who are actually best positioned to understand at least certain aspects of that system. So just to take a basic sort of example, if you're trying to understand how bullying works in schools, you can adopt, if you like, the standpoint of people from the outside, or teachers or parents or people who are making school policy. But there's an aspect to that, the set of processes that make up bullying, that can really be best understood by the people who are subject to it. And if you really want to understand that process, you're going to have to draw on their kinds of insights. And so I think this idea is at the heart of what I call standpoint eugenics. And as you've said, it's not the idea of standpoint theory is not my idea. It's a long idea that's best known perhaps in amongst philosophers and people working in the social sciences and humanities through feminist standpoint theory. So if you want to understand phenomena that have to do with sexualization and gender oppression, you need to be able to absorb, take in, adopt the perspectives of those who are most affected by practices like harassment or rape or sexual assault or forms of gender exclusion, and they would typically be women. So, you know, that's why it's part of feminist standpoint theory. And that idea itself draws on a longer tradition in Marxist theory, in political philosophy, the idea that you can best understand the operation of an economic system like capitalism by adopting the perspective of the workers, the people who are most directly exploited by the economic system that you're trying to understand the operation of. And that was an insight that went back to the work of Karl Marx.
So let me ask about the moral aspect. You know, before we, you know, I want to get to this idea of, you know, human variation and the sort of the thinking that goes behind eugenic practices. We talk about eugenics. It's associated often, as you mentioned, with Nazi Germany, which in itself, you know, always raises flags about immoral practices in general. But what is it about eugenics that is somehow, you know, morally repugnant? And you mentioned in the book, I mean, there's a couple of, you know, there's clear cases of, you know, failures of consent, to sterilization, for example, or, you know, people who are, you know, wrongfully put in institutions as mental defectives, which itself is a wrong, and then they are sterilized, which is kind of another wrong. There are botched operations, as you mentioned, in the sterilization. So there are lots of things that are morally wrong that we would all recognize as such, involving consent and such. But I'm just wondering, if you have consent, you know, and it's not, you know, none of these other issues arise. Is there something else that is somehow wrong about eugenics? And I mention this because one of the people you talk about is, I think it's Nicholas Agar, you know, that there are actually morally acceptable forms of, you know, improving the human stock, as you put it, or as Galton put it. So could you say a bit about the moral valence of eugenics sort of as such?
Sure. Yeah, you're certainly right that there are many dimensions to the ethics of eugenics and concerning consent and bodily interference and wrongful classification and so on. And there is some virtue to the idea of let's abstract away from those and try and get at, you know, I don't know if we'd want to call it, you know, the pure version of eugenics, or, you know, the best case scenario for eugenics. What, you know, what would we say about that? Is there still some kind of underlying moral problem? And I guess, you know, my answer is, yeah, in principle, there may well be forms of eugenics that are, if you like, less problematic or, you know, free of all the complete taint of that eugenics has taken on historically. But I'm pretty wary about jumping down into that sort of end of the pool too quickly, partly because I think the lesson of the history is that that's exactly how the founders of eugenics thought about their initial project. They thought about it as being morally unproblematic, and they didn't see any problem, for example, in thinking of certain kinds of people as being unfit. So, for example, there was no problem at all in thinking about people who were born into impoverished families. They were called paupers, and the problem was pauperism that they gave rise to. And the idea was that we could solve the problem of pauperism in society, of poverty, by sterilizing people in poor families. Now, you know, now we might say, for the most part, I believe actually there's still people who think that's actually still an appropriate response to the problem of poverty now. I think they're a small sort of minority. Society's moved on. But that was in many ways the ways in which the eugenics movement started. That wouldn't seem to be problematic. And I don't think it's just that, oh, they kind of didn't have the right science or didn't get it right there. There's this idea that the first move in eugenics, remember, it's not just a project of human improvement, it's human improvement intergenerationally and by changing the composition of the population. And you've got to draw that distinction between the fitter and the less fit kinds of people, and then you've got to put some flesh on those bones. And what the lesson of history is, I think, that we will go wrong almost certainly very early in this process of trying to figure out, for example, who the fit and who the unfit are there. So I think that it's not that I would say you couldn't do it in principle, that there wouldn't be a pure sort of version, but in the very project of starting to think about, you know, better and worse kinds of people, the lesson of history is that we go wrong quickly, very easily. I think, for example, today, and I think Nick Agar, at least at one time, was certainly what I think of as sort of in the space of, you know, amongst a cluster of philosophers in bioethics and moral philosophy who are very kind of pro-eugenic. They're very willing to, and they still are willing to explore this pro-eugenic sort of space. Look at the, you know, forms of eugenics that, you know, we could actually endorse, or maybe that we should endorse. And I think the way that's panned out in terms of, you know, the sort of concrete realities, you get views that, for example, you know, you associated with somebody like Julian Savulescu, one of the people in this cluster I've just had some engagement with in an article that's just out in Mind, that, you know, the idea that, you know, parents have an obligation to create the, you know, best children they can, this principle that he calls procreative beneficence, that's gotten a lot of attention in the literature. And there's very quickly drawn the conclusion that parents have an obligation to create children who are disability free. And what I've been interested in this context is interrogating that very simple sounding move from that general sort of premise, you know, that's cast in terms of, you know, more well-being to therefore less disability. And I try to argue that actually it's very problematic inference to make in light of the empirical literature on well-being and disability, and there's a variety of philosophical moves on that front. So even in cases now when I think people are trying themselves to make the best case for a kind of clean version of eugenics, it ends up repeating some of those errors from the beginning. They might be, you know, new manifestations, but it's the same root problem, that it's very difficult to make good on this promise of distinguishing between, you know, the good sorts of people and the bad sorts of people, to use the language that Galton was using early on for those to sort of fill human stock in future generations.
Okay. I mean, I would assume, I mean, just to kind of continue with the question, you know, breeding out the Huntington's gene, for example, which is a fairly simple thing to do, as opposed to, you know, poverty. It seems that it would be odd to say, well, no, we should not do that, even if we had the power to do it. I mean, that seems to be something that is a clear cut, I would argue, or one might argue, that that's a clear cut case of improving, you know, the human stock in a certain way. It's not that we have to treat those people who have Huntington's in a poor manner or not, or, you know, not get their consent or anything like that. So, you know, setting that aside, but, you know, ceteris paribus, if the Huntington's gene could be eradicated, one might say, well, that would be a good thing, right? Or no? Or is that just a slippery slope to all these other sorts of things, and we're just not able to distinguish, you know, good people versus bad people in any way that might not be morally problematic?
No, I think you're right that we could draw that distinction and say, certainly in principle, that would be a good thing. Another example that people often bring up in this context is Tay-Sachs, which involves, you know, up to, you know, one of up to 100 mutations on chromosome 15. And for the most part, certainly the infantile forms, it gives rise to very short, medically deeply challenged lives, with a variety of neurological impairments that are regarded typically as quite severe. Again, I think the sentiment that wouldn't human life be better if we didn't have Tay-Sachs? I think very few people would say, no, let's have more of that. But again, once we move to questions of, well, how would you implement this and what would this mean? I mean, it might be that those two cases, and it's interesting because one involves a dominant and one involves a recessive gene and so on, you know, and they're both incredibly give rise to very undesirable sorts of traits. But one important interesting difference is that Huntington's is typically, as you know, late onset. And so there are existing people who carry the gene for it. And there are questions about how various forms of genetic testing of them and decisions they make about their own autonomy and family life and so on are impacted by policies we would introduce now. And this actually is relevant when we start to think about eugenics in practice, moving beyond just, you know, in principle, couldn't this be a good thing? Can't we agree on this ground and get over that first hurdle that I was describing, first moral hurdle of distinction between the sort of fit and unfit? Because if you take a case, for example, that's perhaps, you know, it's not that these are not realistic cases, but a case that would have much more sort of impact and is much more central to actual screening practices now. Take a case like trisomy 21, which is the condition that's associated with strongly with Down syndrome. And there's widespread prenatal screening for it. Any policy that you're going to introduce now is going to affect a whole community of people who have Down syndrome now and the way they're viewed. So another aspect of this, once you draw that distinction and introduce medical and social policies on the basis of this distinction between better and worse sorts of people, is you're going to be expressing something about exactly what might be up for debate, but something and something negative about people who have that condition now. And that has been the reaction of people, for the most part, within the Down syndrome community, of the ongoing sorts of practices to get rid of Down syndrome. Again, from the outside, we might think, well, wouldn't it be better if the world didn't have Down syndrome? That's not the view of many people with Down syndrome and many people who parent with children with Down syndrome. That's one of the things that I learned, and it was a real shift for me coming at this from this abstract philosophical standpoint, if you like, to being able to share experiences with people in our community who had this standpoint. So this connects to the sort of standpoint eugenics or standpoint disability perspective that pervades the thinking that's manifest in the book. So I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So just to add another dimension to this, I mean, the other thing that you might think of is you might think, well, surely if we agree that human improvement is a good thing over generational time, I'm not opposed to that. So, not that I'm anti-enhancement. How else could we get it? So you take a sort of analogy, look, Wilson, are you going to be against doing things like removing lead from playgrounds, because lead, when kids get lead on their hands and they absorb it, they often end up with some kind of neurological damage, and that leads to mental impairment. So you're saying, we don't want to distinguish between different kinds of people and stigmatize people or subhumanize them or something like that. And I'm not tied to it being a biological intervention, that it could be an environmental one that causes this change over generational time, or in developmental time for that matter. Or vaccination against polio, right? Wouldn't it be better if we didn't have people who had polio? I agree with that. But now think about, what the way you're going to implement that now is, it's not all playgrounds. It's, playgrounds in, rich kids' areas, or it's only people from, who can pay for it who get the polio vaccination. We're going to, implement a social policy on that basis. Now you've kind of got this, at the implementation stage, for whatever reason, you've now got this sort of distinction between the haves and the have-nots, and you're reinforcing a kind of difference there. And I tend to think that's the way in which a lot of the eugenic sorts of interventions have gone. So even when you're agreeing on a desirable sort of goal and an aim in terms of the sorts of people you want to populate future generations, when you turn to the actual implementation, you've got another morally problematic dimension when it isn't applied sort of universally. So what I'm saying is that if you could have a regime of human improvement that was, in the appropriate kind of sense, egalitarian, or treating each person fully as a person, then that's much less problematic than the forms that have actually been in place, and I think still continue to be in place, which still rest on this sort of distinction, either at the more abstract conceptual level or at the implementation level, of distinguishing between two sorts of people who are on different sides of that intervention.
Okay, so one of the, you have a table and discuss a number of different eugenic traits. You mentioned, poverty, which kind of strikes, us maybe today as an odd thing to think of as something that you breed out. But there is this idea, as you've mentioned a number of times, between, the fit and the less fit, and the, the good humans and the bad humans, or at least the good traits, the bad traits. And this seems to be something that is just kind of with us. Could you explain a bit about this, what you call difference between just variation of between humans and then negatively marked differences.
Yeah, sure. So one of the things that I talk about in the middle of the book, so the middle part of the book is concerned with what I call the social mechanics of eugenics. How does it sort of, how do you go from idea to actually maintaining a sort of set of eugenic policies or a regime? How do you put this into practice? And in that suite of chapters, I've got a couple of chapters that are on what I call the puzzle of marked variation. And I think the puzzle is pretty easy to state. And it's this, that, there's an infinite amount of variation in human populations. That's in some sense the nature of the beast. We vary with respect to how many hairs we have on our head. We vary with respect to exactly how long to the nearest microcentimeter our hands are or our arms are or our legs are. And we could line people up and we could do statistics on the distribution of where people stood with respect to, potential infinity of traits. So the idea is that, if you like, ontologically, variation is everywhere. But epistemically, in terms of what we notice, we only pick up on certain kinds of variation. And the puzzle is, why is there that sort of mismatch, or what's the basis for, the restriction to the certain kinds of things that we mark as variation that's worth paying attention to? And obviously the connection with eugenics here is the ones that in the eugenic context that we pay attention to are the ones that the traits that you might want to sterilize on the basis of, or you might want to deny people admission to your country through your immigration policy restrictions because of country of origin or because of their putative feeble-mindedness or mental deficiency or, failing to pass some kind of genetic test or having some kind of transmissible disease like HIV, for example. So I was just interested in this as a general issue. What's the bait? How do we think about this problem of, or this puzzle of marked variation? So I see it as quite a general sort of problem that's got a particular connection to eugenics and disability. And part of the way in which I came to think about it was through an interaction, maybe about 10 years ago, with the disability studies scholar Leonard Davis, and particularly through his book Enforcing Normalcy, where it's been very influential and widely read, and I think rightly so. It's a great book. But early in the book, he takes the term puzzle of marked variation, that's my little moniker for something. But essentially, I see him as talking about this. His claim is in a sort of Foucauldian tradition that disability was itself socially constructed in the 19th century through the eugenics movement. If you put it in these stark Foucauldian sorts of terms, you say, disability was sort of created, almost at a moment, sometime in the late 19th century through a particular set of social practices and ideas, institutions. Then and before that, it didn't exist. And part of the claim he makes in laying out this idea is that the idea of normalcy itself is quite a new notion that's tied up in that same period, somewhere between 1840 and 1900, and it's tied up particularly with the development of statistical techniques and the idea of norming individuals, locating individuals somewhere in what we now call a normal distribution of traits. And it's certainly true that those techniques and those ideas and those set of practices associated with eugenics all developed at that time. But I was always unsatisfied with this particular account, and maybe I'm dissatisfied more generally with this kind of social constructivist move in other areas, I'm not sure. But in this context, it didn't make a lot of sense to me that this kind of normativity and this norming of individuals was such a recent thing. And it's partly comes from my philosophy background where I thought, no, hang on, we've been talking about norms and sort of sorts of individuals and kinds of individuals and fitting them into these categories and distributions way before we had the particular mathematical statistical techniques for representing them and the particular words like eugenics and categories like moron and imbecile and so on, which all developed later. And so I was interested in trying to probe a bit deeper. So part of it, the bigger picture here, and this is maybe where it comes back to my background in cognitive science and philosophy of mind a little bit more, is that I tend to think that we need to think a lot more about the connections between the cognitive, biological, and social sciences, what I've previously called the fragile sciences, in order to make progress on any one of those in particular. So, of course, there's a lot of good work that's done just in cognitive science or just in philosophy of biology within that kind of silo. But for quite a while now, maybe 15 years or so, I've been crossing between those sorts of boundaries. And so, for example, in the work I referred to early on when I talked about individualism in the philosophy of mind, I also started to pursue that theme much more into the biological sciences. So I was interested in levels of selection and the nature of species as individuals and a whole suite of themes there. And in recent work, I've been pursuing that much more in the social sciences as well. So given that background, it made sense for me to think about this puzzle of marked variation from that perspective of think about, well, shouldn't we think about it not just in terms of the development of particular sorts of social structures and the kind of investigation that people in the social sciences might do or humanities, but we should also think about the kinds of cognitive structures that we have that interact with social structures in various ways to bring about these longer term sorts of changes. So that's the way I start to think about the origins of normalcy. Not that we just have some basic, innate dispositions in thinking about the sorts of people there are, but rather there's a whole bunch of cognitive structuring that we have that interacts with our social environment, and it's that interaction between the two of them that give rise to what ends up being something like eugenics down the track and marking this vast amount of human variation there is in particular sorts of ways in terms of there being better sorts of people and worse sorts of people.
Well, there's definitely a us them sorting that pretty much is ubiquitous. It seems to always be going on. Whether that's all, I suppose you mentioned that as we sort ourselves, there's a kind of a normative uptake to that. Is any kind of sorting going to have this normative aspect that leads to eugenic thinking?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to sound that fatalistic about it, but you're right. I mean, I think so the way I kind of approach it in this part of the book is I talk about there being this cognitively mediated normativity. And so I take the idea that I use a kind of analogy from the developmental literature and the idea that we have what has sometimes been called these like me detectors that you can find very early in infancy. It looks as though there's been a fair bit of discussion of this recently where some of these results have been a challenge, but I'm not interested in going through rehearsing that right here. But I took that idea to say, well, I think we've got something like that. We've got what I call like us detectors. But for those to work, and that makes sense. So this partly came out of work that I was doing on kinship separately. So often when I start off down a different pathway, I think is independent, it kind of gets roped back into something else I've worked on, 5 years before or in another part of my brain somewhere. It's a very positive thing to be able to figure out who are the people who are sort of like us. And we can see ourselves as being a member of a group that they constitute, whether it's a family group or it might be a nation or somewhere in between. But the flip side of that is that there are those who aren't like us. If we've got a way to detect those who are like us, the flip side is there's going to be this us and them sort of thinking. And I think historically that's been quite prevalent. But here the big caution is hang on, let's stop here. I'm not saying that. We've got something inbuilt in us that makes us xenophobic, for example, because the question is, how do we build up that us category? What's the we can only do that through the kind of social scaffolding that we are already born into, that's already there as a result of what's happened previously in human history. And this might be the grounds for a bit more sort of optimism, because there's a lot of contingency in what goes into that, and there's potentially a lot of control that we can exercise so that we think about the us here in different kinds of ways, because it's not as though the way in which according to me, these like us detectors, I mean, they can't really operate without there being a lot of socially constructed environment out there already. And so this is the sense in which I'm trying to offer what I call a psychosocial or sociocognitive, I use, I think, both terms, account of the puzzle of marked variation.
Okay, so you mentioned also earlier Savulescu, or I believe it was him, and probably others as well, the principle of procreative beneficence, right? That parents have a moral obligation to give their offspring the best chance that they have at a good life or the best kind of life. And you call this the sort of the same eliminativist logic as old school eugenics, right? There's no, it carries forward the same sort of thinking of, you know, before we had sterilization and other practices. Now we have genetic testing, we have selective abortion, and this nugenics, as you also put it, it just reduces that to a matter of individual choice, right? Whether they're going to have the genetic testing and select certain embryos over others, or determine that the fetus is of a one sex or the other, or in some sense, and then abort the one that's undesirable. So I guess this, for me, you know, in my own reading about autonomy and things like that, I was thinking, if nugenics involves these very individual choices, a lot of these choices are choices that are up to women in a way. I mean, selective abortion. I mean, ideally, one would want choices to be made within a family situation or something like that. But I mean, ultimately, as we know from, you know, wars over abortion and pro-life and pro-choice, you know, this it. The whole idea of eugenics and nugenics seems to lead to certain difficult issues between the fight for women to make certain choices, depending on, you know, exercising their own autonomy. And you don't really, you know, this is not something that you go into in detail, so you know, make of it what you will. But for me, there was a very interesting intersection between those two issues once you got to the idea that now we're in a regime of individuals being able to do testing, individuals making certain choices about which fetuses they want to bring to term and which they don't. And that seems to intersect very directly with these other issues for feminism, right? So I was just wondering if you could say something about how you see that intersection.
Okay, I think I can say some things, how satisfactory they are, but maybe another matter. So, you know, the context of this is, you know, what Troy Duster, the sociologist who's worked extensively on eugenics, has called the backdoor to eugenics. Right, the idea that eugenics, you know, can come in not through the front door of state legislation and, you know, for example, explicit sterilization or other regulatory laws imposed by the state, but through individual choice. And it's certainly true that for some people, the real problem with eugenics has got to do with state policies and forcing people to do certain sorts of things or imposing bodily intervention on particular sorts of individuals. So for some people who are perhaps, say, more, you know, libertarian in their leanings, that's really where, you know, the real problems with eugenics are. And clearly I'm not in that camp. I think the problem, there's a whole variety of problems that don't all go away with that. So in this realm of individual choice, which is the one that we are largely in now in terms of things like prenatal screening and the uses of IVF and other technologies, I think there are still significant issues that come up. And some of those, I think you're right, come up particularly for women, and they are certainly feminist issues that both men and women should care a lot about. And there are, I think, some tensions and conflicts in terms of trying to walk your way through what's a potential sort of minefield here. So, for example, if there's a concern about the use of prenatal screening to fuel selective abortion practices, so take the example that I've used before of Down syndrome, which is very widespread, then on the one hand, you've got a woman's right to choose in principle on almost any sort of ground, and one ground that's widely recognized is to avoid having a child with Down syndrome or with trisomy 13 or 18 would be other sorts of examples for which you can test and for which people do test. So on the one hand, there's that right to choose, and for many people that is very fundamental. On the other hand, as somebody like Adrienne Ash, who is pro-choice in using that language, also flagged as problematic, if you're choosing to selectively abort a fetus simply because it's passed, a series of tests indicating an increased likelihood that your child will have Down syndrome, then there's a sense in which that choice expresses something negative about anybody who would have that trait. Because remember, your choice now, it's literally the decision about whether to complete a pregnancy or to terminate a pregnancy. And the only relevant new piece of information you've got is that the child is very likely to have, perhaps even in some cases, will certainly have Down syndrome. What I'm not saying, and I think this is also true of Adrienne Ash's work, she's not saying that women shouldn't have that right. It would be, I think you're right if I'm reading behind the question a little bit, it would be sort of another way to impose a burden on women to suggest that they're doing something morally wrong or shameful or something they shouldn't do if they make that choice. But rather, it's to highlight the way in which that kind of right, which we could respect, still can give rise to problematic kinds of outcomes in the broader context in terms of the sorts of societies that we have and the sorts of human variation that we actually have in our societies. And so, that's an example, I think, of a way in which there's perhaps, a kind of intrinsic conflict that needs to be worked through. I'm not sure of the way to resolve that. I think that people should understand this and grapple with this, what's sometimes called this expressivist objection, the idea that this suite of practices that we just take for granted as unproblematic because they avoid a bad sort of outcome, actually express some kind of something negative about people with that condition. How strong that expression is, I think, is to be debated and sorted out. But I'm quite sympathetic, and I think that to this position that people like Ash and David Wasserman, for example, have articulated, and I actually don't think it's been given its real due in the bioethics and a philosophical community. And so I have a little bit more to say about that, in the book. The broader issue is, in the terms, again, coming back to the history of eugenics, I think that women typically have carried the burden of eugenics more than men. It's not the case that universally and across all contexts that women, for example, were sterilized more or were refused admission on immigration grounds more than men. It varied across time and place. There's global statistics can be sort of misleading. I don't think they're that informative, even if they pan out one way rather than another. But it's certainly true that there's a danger that in introducing, if you like, some of these, what you might think of as finer points of argumentation, that you could be reimposing new sorts of burdens that particularly affect women or that disproportionately have an impact on them as the people who carry fetuses to term, who are primarily even now in North America, Australia, most of Europe, regarded as the primary care providers for children, and who tend to have lower levels of income in which to support children with disabilities and so on, right? So I think we have to really think about the social reality of these sorts of abstract ideas that quickly turn into policies. And that maybe brings me back to where you started with that question, which was about this principle of procreative beneficence. Again, I've talked about it a little bit earlier, but it's not just, I mean, it is built on this idea that, you know, parents should do the best for their children, but it's really the extension of that idea to claim that, well, parents have on that basis, if that's true, then they have an obligation to create the best possible child that they can. And that's often cashed out in terms of the idea of well-being. And then, you know, again, you've got this abstract sounding idea that sounds good, but then how do you implement it? Well, the way it gets implemented through the intermesh with current technologies and ideas that are floating around, and it has been defended this way by people like Savulescu and Kahan, is to suggest that we should have, you know, effectively disability-free procreation, and we should use technology, not only in some soft sense of should, but there's actually a stronger sense in which there's a kind of, you know, there's a moral reason, in the strongest case, there's a parental obligation to create disability-free children. And I think that move itself is, again, as I've said before, deeply problematic. And I think there's no quick way to make that move from this general, generally acceptable premise to this still quite general sounding premise about disability-free procreation. But this is one that will have, you know, will have massive influences on the lives of people who exist now, and certainly will change the composition of human populations over generational time.
Oh, okay. So we're getting towards the end of our time. I wanted to, at the very end of the book, you talk about standpoint epistemology, which is, as you mentioned before, sort of where you began when you started thinking about these issues, and the whole politics, as you put it, of knowing at the margins, right? Who knows and who cares about who knows? Do you want to say something about those final chapters on standpoint epistemology?
Yeah, sure. So the last couple of chapters, after I finished talking about the social mechanics of eugenics, I step back a little bit and come back to this idea, which I treat in this general way in the beginning of the book, of standpoint eugenics. And so what I try to do in the last part is I try to go beyond the basic kind of intuition that there are, you know, people who are oppressed by a certain kind of system or regime are often in the best position to understand at least certain aspects of that system or those practices. And I try to look at how that has been spelt out more, maybe formally is too strong, but more explicitly within standpoint theory and the humanities and social sciences, and standpoint epistemology within philosophy in particular. So there's a little bit of background work there where I kind of have a bit of a dig, I guess people could say, at analytic epistemology. I've never been a very big fan of the S knows the P game. That is still very central. And so one of the things I do quickly is just take a quick look at the ways in which people have treated the relationship between knowledge and context, or epistemology and context. So there's, you know, been a big, as I'm sure you know and many of your listeners will know, there's been a big drive in the last 10 to 15 years around this topic called contextualism in epistemology, the idea that knowledge is context sensitive in various kinds of ways, and it's given rise to a, you know, really rich, intricate kind of literature amongst analytic epistemologists. But there's also this other tradition in standpoint epistemology of thinking about the ways in which knowledge and context operate. The position of the knower is crucial, associated with people like Sandra Harding, for example, in naturalistic philosophy of science and naturalistic epistemology. And what I just, you know, in a very amateurish kind of way did is just looked at some of the cross-citation practices in, for example, the relevant Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy articles, and found, really to my shock initially, that there's just no overlap between these two sorts of literatures. So when people are doing standpoint epistemology in feminism, it is its own very rich field and has big influence, but It's not making the connection, and it's not being recognized and referring to and having the appropriate sort of intersections with this other thing that you might think it should have. Like, there's this other body of literature that gets, in some sense, it's got much higher prestige, I think, within analytic philosophy. And it's you know, central to what are often regarded as the mainstream sorts of journals and so on. And this fits into, I think, a broader set of citation practices that themselves marginalize innovative areas of philosophy. So there's a bit of a beef about that that sets the tone for this. If people want to get on a hobby horse one way or other, engage with that, that's there. But part of that's just background to looking at how would you really apply standpoint theory, which typically in its standard forms, how would you apply it over to the eugenics case? How would you, you know, really make this a more rigorous idea beyond just the sort of intuitions I've articulated about standpoint eugenics? How would you apply it to the disability case? And there I become actually somewhat critical of standpoint theorists here, or the potential for trying to point out the limits of standpoint theory in dealing with disability. And I'm hoping that that engages people in a friendly sort of way, a constructive way, who are committed to standpoint theory and epistemology and can either meet some of the challenges that are posed for how to develop it with respect to disability and eugenics. And it might lead to me, you know, changing my own views about this as well. So it's a little bit less developed ideas that aren't tried out as much. But the basic idea is that in at least the standard forms of standpoint epistemology, traditional sorts of forms, you know, it relies on there being a kind of binary or binary-like opposition between two classes. So in classic Marxist theory, it's between members of the bourgeoisie and members of the proletariat, or members of the working class, the capital class, and, you know, who are oppressing people in the oppressed class, the proletariat or working class. And I think the same sort of idea is meant to apply over to sex and gender, and also people apply it over to racial categories as well. And I think once we move beyond these foundational cases where most of the discussion has been focused to categories, for example, of intellectual disability or disability more generally, the kinds of categories, the kinds of, you know, eugenic traits that populate the history of eugenics that I talk about in chapter 3 of the book, things break down a little bit. There are ways in which, you know, part of the problem, I think, is that you know, there's a sense in which we, I think, pretty clearly want to say that some of these ways of categorizing people aren't, you know, they're not real ways of categorizing people. I mean, in the extreme case, you might want to say, well, the whole idea of feeble-mindedness, which was one of these central traits, it's ensconced in much of the legislation. It's the most heavily referred to trait. There isn't such a thing, you know. So if you're trying to organize a standpoint theory around the oppressed, the feeble-minded, but on the other hand, saying, but there isn't such a thing as feeble-mindedness, that's tricky. I think it minimally it complicates the kind of account that you have to give, and certainly standpoint theory in feminism has grappled with and dealt with some of these issues around under the heading of intersectionality and so on. So I realize there's much more to be said than I do in the book on this. I've just tried to, in some sense, get this conversation going a bit without it becoming you know, what I think of as a distraction from the main part of the book. I think this is an issue that people in philosophy and people in feminist philosophy would be maybe more interested in than what I see as the main audience for the book, which is much, much broader, not only in philosophy, but across history, sociology, disability studies, you know, studies of, you know, of race and ethnicity, you know, work in not just the philosophy of biology, but philosophy of medicine, work around science, technology, society, and so on. So that's partly why I actually rewrote a lot of the book, so that kind of stuff just comes at the end and didn't, you know, structure things right from the beginning. Just the sort of idea of standpoint eugenics did.
Okay. Well, we have time for one question, which is just, what is on the horizon for you? What's your next project or projects?
So I have recently moved back to Australia after a 30-year detour in North America. Unintended, but very exciting, and I'm very grateful for that, but it's good to be back. And so I'm trying to still, after a year, get myself established a little bit more. I've set up a network called the People Network, Philosophical Engagement in Public Life, that is based in Melbourne, and we have about 100 people involved in that network. Brings together some of my work in philosophy in the schools, trying to get some sort of day camp experiences together, the kind that we had alive in Alberta that were very successful. So that's taking up a fair bit of time and attention. It's very exciting. It's great to be connected back with Australian philosophy again in a more direct way. I've just finished a book on kinship called Relative Beings, well, nearly a year ago, and some of that has come out in anthropology journals, and that was something that I was writing alongside the Eugenic Mind Project, and continues this thinking about the fragile sciences that start off in Boundaries of the Mind and Genes and the Agents of Life, and that's got traces staining the pages of the Eugenic Mind Project as well. So that's where I'm at now, building new sorts of community connections, thinking a lot about curriculum, thinking a lot about the diversity of what we teach and research in philosophy. So I'm very interested in thinking a bit harder than I think we have collectively about Indigenous philosophy, about non-Western philosophy traditions, and I've restructured some of the curriculum at La Trobe accordingly. So, it's exciting times. And plus, the West Coast Eagles just won the Aussie Rules Grand Final, so how could things get any better?
What could be better, right? So, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your taking the time to talk about your new book. It was very eye-opening to learn about the not just the history but also the contemporary aspects, and then looking at it much more closely than I had ever thought about it before. You've been listening to my interview with Robert Wilson, professor of philosophy at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. His new book, The Eugenic Mind Project, is just out from the MIT Press. This is New Books in Philosophy. I'm Carrie Figdor. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.